From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, guest host for this special edition of PCUSA. On this special program, we're going to examine the current Ebola crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC. The DRC's Ministry of Health officially declared the latest outbreak of Ebola virus in North Kivu Province on August 1st, 2018, but the outbreak likely began months earlier. It is the 10th outbreak of Ebola in the DRC in 40 years and is described as the worst outbreak on record by the medical aid group MSF, also known as Doctors Without Borders. They say it is the second largest epidemic of Ebola recorded anywhere behind the West Africa outbreak of 2014 through 2016. Despite having new advancements such as an investigational vaccine and developmental treatments, the crisis is still not under control. Nearly 2,000 people have died from the virus, and patients have been identified in new geographical areas in the past few weeks, including South Kivu Province. Aid groups have repeatedly stressed that the spread of this deadly virus cannot be stopped without building greater trust between those involved in the Ebola response and the local communities directly affected. They also believe the Ebola response should be integrated into local healthcare facilities so that medical services are easier for people to access. In addition, the Red Cross warns that the availability of an effective vaccine against Ebola and the recent confirmation of two effective treatments do not negate the importance of building trust and understanding in communities affected by the outbreak. Well, to help us navigate through some of these issues surrounding the Ebola crisis in the DRC, we have with us today Lawrence Gostin. He's professor of law at Georgetown University and director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Laws. Also, my colleagues, Idriss Fall, VOA editor for the French to Africa service, and Mill Arcega, television correspondent for VOA's English division. And Mill, you have just returned from Goma, DRC, so I will go ahead and start with
sure.
You. You observe firsthand medical teams working in the various provinces affected by the Ebola virus. So can you describe for us what you observed in terms of how they're going about receiving treatment?
I did see dozens of patients who were infected, many of them young children, at the Ebola Treatment Center in Butembo. Now, part of the problem here as a reporter when you walk into these kinds of situations is it is a media event. We had so much local media there because essentially this was the first visit by the Health and Human Services Secretary to this part of the world to deal with this Ebola crisis, which, as you said, is now the second worst outbreak in history. So certainly the response was there. We had teams from the CDC, we had teams from WHO, and the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Diseases, the head of that, Dr. Fauci, was there. But here's what I got out of it. I got a sense of hope out of seeing some of these treatment facilities there and some of the children and some of the infected people who were being treated. Now, that may be sort of a boilerplate response that I got as a result of being part of a bubble that was really traveling there from the United States to see these Ebola treatment centers. But I can tell you that a lot of what I experienced there was a sense of hope, a little bit more optimism than before, because some of the scientists were explaining to me the development of two new treatments drugs, the monoclonal antibody 114 and the Regeneron drug that they had pulled out of a clinical trial because it was proving to be so effective at reducing mortality rates in some of these children. So what I can tell you is, from what I saw, there's a lot of processes that have been put in place to make sure that the in and out travel of people from infected areas to areas that are not is being stopped and very regulated. I also got the sense that they were receiving sufficient help from the CDC in terms of training and that they were receiving the drugs that they needed. I've heard on the contrary to that as well.
Also, you mentioned Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's head of the National Institutes of Health's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. He's on the ground there treating Ebola patients himself, and you had a chance to speak with him. So what did he say about treatment? How is it going?
He talked a lot about his collaboration with Professor J.J. Muyembe from Kinshasa's Biomedical Research Institute, and they were really sort of two key players in the development of these two drugs that are now proven to be very, very very effective. What he explained to me was they found some of the infected people who had survived Ebola. They brought them to the United States and actually developed the antibodies from the blood of some of these patients. It has proven to be very effective in reducing mortality rates. In some cases, as mortality rates had dropped to less than 10%. So what he was telling me was he got a sense of hope out of his visit there and the fact that these communities are trying to work together to cooperate amongst the intergovernmental bodies. Part of the problem for me as a reporter is it's very confusing. Who's in charge of what?
Yes, and also just one more question on your experience there. Did you find that the WHO was holding back based on what Doctors Without Borders
I did not get that sense at all. I have heard reports that they were holding back. I don't know if they are holding back, as there may be a problem in the infrastructure and in the actual distribution of some of these medicines. It's very new. I think two Florida companies are actually producing these vaccines. I was told that they were producing them in quantities large enough to be distributed to some of the areas that need it, but I did not get the sense at all from my interviews with heads of the WHO. I spoke with Professor Tedros there, and I did not get that sense at all that there was any withholding going on in terms of these drugs. What I did get is there's a lot of challenges in convincing some of these people and some of the villages that, in fact, the Ebola treatment centers are not dying centers. They are, in fact, places where you can heal.
Well, that's really good to hear. And Professor Gustin, you've written several papers on the Ebola crisis. And in one of your papers, Ebola and War in the Democratic Republic of Congo, you talk about what the international community should be doing in response. So what are some of your recommendations that can work to reduce the spread?
First, let me just add some context and facts
Absolutely.
To this discussion. Doctors Without Borders have talked about WHO holding back vaccines, not treatments. And so they've recently decided to put in another vaccine, a Johnson & Johnson vaccine. The current one is with Merck. That may aid certain things. The other thing is that it's very encouraging to hear that there's hope, but I've heard it so long, so many times, and the fundamentals have changed in terms of biomedicine. Treatments, fantastic. Vaccines, fantastic. But the fundamentals in terms of disease spread are still there. Lots of political violence, lots of community distrust, still a little bit of dysfunction in the government. So I recommended, along with a group of international experts, a really major surge in the response. First of all, while WHO says that the U.S. and others are giving enough money, it still has a chronic funding deficit. Secondly, CDC is not on the ground. In fact, CDC has been banned from the hot zone. They were there with Alex Azar, the Secretary of Health, but that was more of a show.
What I was told, however, was there were 35 CDC personnel in Goma. That's what they told me.
Most of it's been in Kinshasa, a little in Goma, but really in the major hot zone, the State Department has banned them because of political violence. Mm-hmm. And that's been an issue in the global health community for quite some time. I know CDC itself really wants to be able to get in there. So the idea of, you know, a fulsome response is, I don't think, true. Secretary Azar, this is the first time he's been there. Him, CDC, and others should have been there for a long, long time before that. So I'm not going to let my government off the hook. I want them to do more. Mm-hmm. President Obama transformed the West Africa Ebola outbreak by really taking leadership. He got a $1.2 billion emergency appropriation. He sent the military in for logistics. He led a Security Council resolution. We're not seeing that kind of leadership currently. So this is what we need, Kim. We need diplomacy to try to stem the violence. We need to build community trust from the ground up and really have what I call community policing rather than security forces coming in to work cooperatively with the community. We need local leaders to take more charge. We need anthropologists to understand the culture. And we also need the United Nations to have peacekeepers that, as I say, are trained for the Ebola response, not for some other response, and also are trained embedded in the community using community policing methods. Because right now, the truth is, The DRC forces are distrusted by the community. The UN is distrusted by the community, and even first responders like WHO and MSF have been targeted. So we really do need to do a much better job about calming it. One last thing that I think is terribly important. I worry in this world of global health that what we're seeing in the DRC is the new normal. And so we're going to have to deal with how we change the public health rulebook when we're dealing in places that are suffering complex humanitarian crises. You know, Yemen, Somalia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, the DRC, Northern Nigeria. All these places can really be a hotbed for disease, and we need to figure out how we change the regular way we do business in those kinds of environments.
Okay, great. And Idris, I want to bring you in on this. Go ahead.
Yes, Idris. Professor, you mentioned what President Obama did during the crisis in West Africa. First, it came very late.
It did, very late. You're right.
And then I think sending doctors around Beni up there in DRC, it may be complicated. You see that physician from Cameroon got killed.
Yes.
So if you bring white Americans up there in Beni, I am sure there are some rebels there who love to catch one American because affiliate to ISIS. So how can you deal with that? Take American white guys, physician or not, bring them to Beni to fight Ebola. How is it possible?
I do think it's possible, and the CDC does think it's possible. I'm not talking about, you know, white doctors coming in with distrust. What I'm talking about is really experienced Ebola fighters that can do proper surveillance, contact tracing. Right now, a very, very large percentage of people are dying in the community unknown to surveillance. And so the CDC has amazing capacities. After all, WHO are many foreign, and I totally agree with you. You want partnerships. You want deep, deep, close, embedded partnerships. You don't want heroes just jumping in on, you know, parachuting in. Absolutely. Right. I totally agree with you. But I do think there's a way to do it. And with every Ebola outbreak in Africa, the CDC's been there, and they've been invaluable. Why wouldn't you want some of your most experienced Ebola fighters on the ground?
I think building bridges is exactly what the health secretary was trying to accomplish while he was there. He met with a lot of community leaders who talked to him about the problems. But my sense on the ground is, as you mentioned, Professor, it's a security issue. You've got this very complicated medical issue with Ebola, and there are treatments there to at least minimize the impact of that. But then you have all these outside forces. You have 100 warring factions along that very porous eastern border.
Yes.
And controlling that is probably the most difficult part, because when we traveled there, we were in a bubble. There was no way that we could actually see how the real world operates there.
Yeah.
I know that health workers are being attacked and some of them are being killed. And the problem with issuing vaccines in some of these parts of the world is you put yourself at risk if you're a health worker trying to distribute vaccines that some of these groups suggest is a poison. That's some of the problems that we're dealing with in that region.
It is.
Absolutely. And this is a great discussion. We're just going to take a quick break and then come right back. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Lawrence Gostin, professor of law at the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law at Georgetown University Law Center here in Washington, D.C., along with my colleagues, Mil Arcega, television correspondent for VOA's English division, and VOA French to Africa editor Idris Fall. I'm Kim Lewis, and this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And a new VOA English app for both Android and Apple devices has been developed, and we encourage you to download and use them. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal fan, Ernest Dunia, from from Pambagua, Kaduna State, Nigeria. Greetings, Ernest, and thank you for tuning in. And if you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com, or you can like us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page. Now, returning to our topic of discussion, the Ebola crisis in the DRC. And Idris, I just wanted to come back to you and looking at this from a cultural perspective. For instance, the director of the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, Dr. Emmanuel Cabobianco, says, "We are asking people to leave the safety of their homes when they fall sick to go to an isolated cell in an Ebola treatment center where their lives are in the hands of complete strangers. We are asking communities to change the way they care for the sick and the dead in ways that go against their traditions. And we are doing all this in communities that have learned to distrust outsiders following decades of violence and unrest." Now, that's a mouthful, but that is what the medical community is having to cope with and what you all were just discussing just a minute ago. So a big challenge is a behavioral challenge that the medical community had to cope with during the Ebola crisis in West Africa. So what lessons were learned from the West Africa Ebola crisis regarding getting people to change behavior, especially if it's going to save lives?
And information. I remember in Guinea, we were among the first radio telling that there is Ebola there in the forest. The government in Conakry did not want to believe us. While we have people telling what's going on there, we had been reporting on it for at least 2 to 3 months. People, like in Congo, they killed some aid workers in Guinea. People burying their dead by themselves, according to their tradition. And the information come very late for the government to recognize it, and it spread from Liberia, Sierra Leone, even rich Mali, even one case in Senegal, because people did not give the information very early. Because if people know that we don't have to shake hands, in Africa, everybody shake hands and hugs. So I think the information early is very, very important to prevent, because if people don't know, they don't trust, and radios, newspapers, television played a role in Guinea to have people change a little bit their mentality. If you are sick, go to a treatment center, but people don't trust.
Also on that note, Red Cross volunteers, they continue to carry out around 20 safe and dignified burials every day. They and other burial teams have responded to more than 11,000 safe and dignified burial requests across North Kivu and Ituri provinces. So what differences do you see is this making regarding fostering trust in the community that they're respecting this burial?
I'm telling you, tradition. You know, there is nothing more difficult to change that tradition. It's deeply rooted inside how people live their traditions. Look in Congo, somebody is sick, you will go see some traditional medicine thinking that that guy can cure you. You tell that guy, and you're spreading a disease. You don't know the guy who's doing that. Even one of them died, the church guy who came from Butembo, because he believed that in speaking, he can cure people. And the government had to come back later telling, hey guys, you men of church, please stay in your churches. Don't go there. Let the physician, the real guys who know how to deal with Ebola, deal with it. People, if you have a problem like in Goma, they have a treatment center, telling people, really, if you have a problem, go there. And go there early, because the disease can take 21 days, I think, to manifest. So people don't know and they don't trust. And that is a cultural thing. And to fight it, it may take time. If you mix with that, what we were talking about, security issues, I'm not like my colleague, not very hopeful with Eastern DRC.
Because it's difficult to break down these cultural barriers that are there. I think that is probably one of the biggest challenges there, is you do have the medicine, but there's a lot of people who don't believe that this medicine works. What was, I think, encouraging for me was I spoke to two Ebola survivors, both of them young women, and they were on a mission really to go travel from one village to the next to visit families and talk to them and try to convince them that there is a cure, that there is a way to reduce the suffering. And I don't know if they're going to succeed. There's only two that I spoke with. You need a lot more than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the burial traditions were a huge problem in the West African outbreak. And it was only until WHO and others realized that you really have to work with communities and respect their traditions and find safe ways to bury the dead in a dignified way consistent with the culture. I think we learned that lesson, and we're starting to do it fairly well in the DRC. But what is really the tough part in the DRC is getting people to trust. And they have every good reason not to trust, because they've been subject to, you know, unspeakable wrongs over the years. They don't trust outsiders. They don't trust their own government.
Their own army
mm-hmm. in particular. And so building that trust has to be job number one. In addition to that, people need to feel safe and secure. The local community does, but also health workers do, and first responders do. And so you really have to do that. You know, there are enormous ways that have been successful in terms of smart diplomacy. The U.S. State Department does operate in places that are difficult, like Afghanistan and things like that. They've just been gun-shy now in relation to the DRC. But, you know, the world's powers can't stand back while MSF, WHO, and others, and local communities are at risk and endangered. You know, we have to share the burden with everyone. And I don't think there's enough global solidarity for this epidemic. And it's not in the media. You mentioned it took a year for President Obama to do it. What changed it? Ebola came to Europe and the United States. We can't wait for that. We can't be complacent. We have to act.
Even though I will say Voice of America was covering this story long before mainstream media in the West Africa crisis, we were on top of that.
No question about
before
it.
Before people even heard
but
that it was there.
But,
yeah.
But you don't see it in the mainstream press in the United States and Europe.
Well, just want to look at another aspect of this. And Professor Gustin, the Ebola outbreak in West Africa in 2014 through 2016 was the worst in history, with more than 30,000 cases reported and a death toll of more than 1,000 people. So from a global perspective, this crisis also exposed a flaw in mechanisms to tackle such health emergencies. And you were just referring to that, meaning by the time the money arrives, the disease has already spread. So the World Bank's Pandemic Emergency Fund came about and has been implemented. However, first of all, what was the thought process behind this? And is it really working?
Is it really working? No, not as intended. I mean, the thought process, it was a brainchild of Jim Kim, who was then the president of the World Bank. So Jim's idea was is that there should be a kind of an insurance policy. And the insurance policy would be for a country, a lower-income country, that experienced a health emergency, that there could be a surge of funding. The problem is it that the pandemic emergency facility was never funded very well. And it had such tight criteria for the longest time. DRC didn't even qualify. Now, if DRC didn't qualify, I don't know who would. So it hasn't worked as intended, but it was well intended. Mohamed Pate is now taken over at the World Bank. He's, you know, from Africa. He's a terrific leader at the bank, and he's really trying to surge up the pandemic finance facility. But we learned a lot of lessons from West Africa, and many of them were for the best. I mean, WHO was useless in West Africa. I was on several global commissions that made strong recommendations of WHO, and to their great credit under Dr. Tedros, they actually have delivered. First of all, Dr. Tedros, who's the Director General of WHO, has been on the ground admirably. He's there. And I really like that. It just shows that personal commitment. The Health Emergencies Program has operated heroically and done extraordinarily well. The Contingency Fund for Emergencies at WHO is in force, but it's way underfunded. So we've made a lot of progress. WHO has come very far, and we've got new, fantastic new vaccines and treatments. It's so much good news. And yet, it's been raging on. we can't get it to stop. And it's because we haven't figured out how to deal with political violence and deep community distrust with unstable governments. If we can unlock that door, it's not going to just help us in the DRC. It's going to help us in hotspots throughout the world. And that is the new normal, I believe.
For DRC also, there is an issue there, the political, because the Minister of Health got fired.
That's right.
Now he's being tried, accused of stealing $4 million.
Yes.
In the middle of an Ebola crisis. You see that kind of thing? Mm-hmm. So nothing is working in DRC. The army is formed by former rebels who used to rape women. There is an hospital in Bukavu. His specialization, the Nobel Prize, is to cure women who had been raped violently. It is in the same region. All the rebellions, some of them helped by Uganda, others helped by Rwanda, they all come from that same region, the Beni region. Besides the Ugandan rebels who are kidnapping kids, killing people, it's very, very complicated. It's so that Rwanda, from Mr. Paul Kagame, they did a lot of send their troops there to try to solve issues. And until now, it's not solved. You have ADF, you have a rebel FDLR, mean the former Rwandan who participated in the genocide. They are there, and they are not very nice guys. So I think to solve the security issue and the trust issue, besides having a government which is not corrupted in DRC, well, that is a... We can work for maybe a century and will not happen.
I think it's a good sign, though, that the former secretary was fired and charged as quickly as he was and a new health minister installed. The sense that I'm getting, at least with the new leadership in DRC, is that they are 100% committed in actually prioritizing fighting, combating Ebola in that region.
I mean, I think that the Ministry of Health has functioned a lot better since that minister was fired. A lot of it was over the dispute of rolling out the second vaccine. He was against it. I think he was wrong on that. I think we've just announced that we're going to roll out that second vaccine, and I think it's probably a good thing. But we do need good health communication so that the community's not confused.
Absolutely. And also, I just wanted to say we earlier talked about personnel being banned from some of the hot zones, such as the CDC,
yes,
even USAID.
That's right.
And this is the U.S. State Department due to the insecurity in the DRC. So we know this is having an effect on strategies to contain the virus. So what is the best way that the U.S. could be handling this situation?
Well, you know, the United States has enormous diplomatic assets, but they're not using them. I think President Trump fears a Benghazi-type incident, as you said, you know, somebody being kidnapped or killed from the United States. So we need to find ways to keep our health workers safe, but you're never going to have it risk-free. WHO, there are other foreign workers there from Europe, MSF, that are taking the risk, but it's a measured risk. But one thing we know is if we don't have all assets on the ground, there will be more community deaths than we need to have. So let's work cooperatively as a community, as a world community, to get this epidemic under control. The State Department should be telling us, what are the triggers for getting our CDC and USAID people back on the ground? How can we keep them safe? There's no transparency. There's literally no transparency. I can tell you, behind the scenes, CDC is deeply frustrated. So is USAID.
And on that note, we will go ahead and stop. Of course, we could go on with this discussion as there's so many different facets to this Ebola crisis in the DRC and even other. We didn't really get into the other outbreaks there, the measles, the diarrheal diseases.
Absolutely.
Outbreaks. So that's all intertwined in that. But I want to thank everyone, and thanks to you, Professor Lawrence Gostin. He is professor of law at Georgetown University and director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center on National and Global global health laws. Thank you for your insights and for taking time from your busy schedule. And my thanks to my colleagues, VOA's French to Africa editor and journalist Idriss Fall, and also television correspondent for VOA's English division, Mel Arcega, just returning from the DRC. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Kim Lewis, your guest host for this special edition of PCUSA. And be sure to join host Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.